And we're live. Hello, everyone. It's your friendly ex-Muslim Abdullah Samir. It's been a while since I've gone live, and it's been almost 7 months since the last live stream. And today, I have a special guest for you, Magan. Magan is actually an ex-Muslim. I'll let him introduce himself, but I'm really excited to have this conversation. He's written some books. He has a podcast. We'll go through all of the different things you've done, but and also why you wanted to talk on the channel and your story. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. So yeah, let's get into it. How's it going? It's bright and early in Australia, right?
It is not so bright yet because the sun isn't out yet. But yeah, it's really early, really early.
Yeah, yeah. So just to get started, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Magan. I'm a Melbournian. Grew up in Melbourne, Australia. I'm a writer, poet. I've got a podcast called The Inner Self Rising. It's on YouTube, everywhere basically. And it's for free thinkers who are interested in self-development and living authentically. So I, you know, kind of philosophical sort of chat to people who I call outliers. That's sort of who I'm trying to connect with. And yeah, that's kind of me. Nutshell.
Nice.
Also, I've got a book that I published last year called "Stop All the Clocks," and it's a small collection of poems. It's 21 poems, and each poem is a response to a favorite film of mine of all time. And so the kind of films relate to the themes in the film relate to the themes of my life. And so I write mainly, you know, about three main things, you know, leaving Islam, the other being, my relationship with my abusive mother, and also, coming to terms with my sexuality as I'm gay. So, yeah.
Wow. Like you've done a lot, and actually, I definitely want to get into your story. So thanks for sharing that. You wanted to talk to me for a while now. In fact, you've emailed me way back when I wasn't actually doing live streams. So I took a little bit of break from live streaming due to some personal things that were going on in my life, a divorce, and I needed some time to myself. And finally, things are actually stabilized now. Things are looking better. But you really wanted to tell your story, and clearly you've been through a lot. And now you're an open ex-Muslim, you're an apostate. Maybe tell us about what motivated you to want to talk about this?
Yeah, it's such a good question. Because, well, you know, most of my life I was, you know, silent. I kept quiet about what, you know, I was going through in terms of my relationship with my abusive mother. And, you know, I'm Somali. And so, you know, I come from a culture that's very honor-based. Shame-based, you know, you got to honor your parents, you got to honor yourself, you got to act in a dignified way. And that sounds good on the surface, you know, you got to, who doesn't want to act in a dignified way? Who doesn't want to be dignified? But
yeah,
the way my culture kind of views dignity is very, it's very oppressive. It's almost very anti-nature.
Depends what you mean by like the definition of being like, it's all about how they define it, right?
Yes, yes. And it's very much tied to, you know, how much you're able to follow the way my culture, you know, views honor based. And a lot of time it's, you know, kind of control over your sexuality, a control over your sense of, in, you know, being an individual and thinking for yourself. And so Somali culture is very, it's very collectivist culture. So you're like, you're not an individual, you're like an extension of the culture.
The group.
Yeah, the group, yeah. So you represent the group and you have to act in accordance with what the group tells you,
mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, for example, being dignified, you have to be straight, you have to get married, you have to have kids, you have to, regardless of what you want, regardless of your sexuality, regardless of your desire, maybe not even to be Muslim, right? Like those things are just not allowed.
Right? Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. So I kind of grew up in, you know, that was kind of my, you know, the thing that I was grappling with, because I had to kind of, you know, obey that. And so for a long time, I did, you know, I'm naturally more of an agreeable person, naturally. And so, you know, which is a kind of a disadvantage if you're in my culture, because, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of, you can get coerced to do things you wouldn't want to do, or in the name of, you know, honor and dignity and stuff like that. And if you're someone who, you know, I do like to be dignified. I do like to, you know, like most people, you know. And so I, you know, didn't speak about me and my story and who I am for most of my life, you know, in a way, as a way to preserve me, you know. And I grew up in a very abusive household, and, you know, one of the main things, you know, an abuser generally does is to isolate you. And so I was quite isolated for most of my life because my mother wanted complete control over me. And so a part of that control was to sort of, you know, perpetuate the narrative that she wanted out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept quiet for most of my life. I didn't talk about what I was going through. I didn't talk about how I felt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, fast forward to now, it's just the number one reason why I want to tell my story is being able to tell my story is a way, it's a part of my healing. It's part of my healing journey. I have to speak. Like I was silent for most of my life. I have to speak. I have to tell my story as a part of my healing. So, yeah.
Amazing. The more voices we have, the harder it is to silence us, and the better life will be for those of us that are following the path that you followed and I followed. So it's definitely a personal journey, and it's also a benefit for the society as well, right? Because it's things have changed a lot in the last 5 years, 10 years since I started talking, and now. Have you faced any backlash from the, maybe that's part of the story too, but for doing saying what you said?
Yes, it's funny because so I grew up very, very so my community is quite you know, Salafi, Wahhabi, quite very, very intense and extreme in terms of its religiosity, and how and the pressure to always, you know, kind of pledge your allegiance to Islam and pledge your allegiance to Muhammad and Allah. And so like all I knew was, you know, I lived in a, it's funny because I always tell people, I came to Australia when I was 4. I'm 37 now.
Okay.
So I've been here most of my life, minus a couple of years that I went to Somalia. But I was in a bubble. I was in a Muslim bubble in Australia. And, you know, I didn't really, all my networks were Muslims. All my friends were Muslim. You know, it's just my whole world and bubble was Muslim. Not only Muslim, but like Salafi Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so when I was, you know, unpacking Islam and what it meant and all that sort of stuff, I for the most part, preemptively kind of cut out a lot of people, because I already knew what the response was going to be.
Yeah.
So I sort of minimized it to the best of my ability. Obviously there was, you know, people who fell through the cracks who I, you know, and we can go through that maybe a bit later throughout this conversation. But yeah, so yes, I did have backlash, but it was in a very strange way from the kind of Muslims who I didn't expect it was really odd, because I got rid of all the Salafis. I got rid of all the intense people before I even left Islam. And then I throughout my journey of being Muslims, a period where I became a Sufi, because I thought maybe that would be
more compatible
with me and more compassionate, because they speak compassion quite often. Okay. And so I you know, I ended up becoming a Sufi, and I quickly learned, they're just the same. They're just the same, you know, exactly the same. They're obsessed with the halals and haram just as much as Salafis. They're just as judgmental. They're just as accepting of the evil parts of Islam, and they justify it, and but with a more, they're more musical in the way they justify their Islam.
Yeah, rather
than Salafis, which I grew up with, which was like, you know, we kill gay people. That's just what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That must have been hard, being gay and also growing up hearing that gays should be killed. How did you reconcile those two things as a Muslim?
Oh, man, it was such a journey. It was such a journey for me to kind of reconcile that, because, you know, I grew up with the, you know, being taught that one of the worst things you could ever be is to be gay. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I almost got the message that it was worse to be gay than to be to leave Islam.
Yeah.
You know, which was really strange. Weird because
strange.
It's very strange, man. It's very strange. Because I thought, well, I think I can't change this.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you want me to do? Like, you know, I'm gonna be condemned to hell. I'm an abomination. I can't change who I am. But then Allah is supposed to be the most compassionate, the most merciful. So, you know, He created me this way. Because at the time, there was no way I would have chosen to be gay growing up. No way. If I had the option to be straight at the time, I would have chosen to be straight.
And this is something I hear from lots of people that are gay ex-Muslims. And even gay Muslims, in fact. And I think the fact that even in societies where homosexuality is completely unacceptable, the fact that there's still gay people like yourself shows that this is not something that we choose, right? And I've kind of moved past the point where I even care to even use that defense, because it's like, we don't need to justify how we want to live our lives, even if that was a choice. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't need to justify it to anyone, right? It's my life, my one and only life that I have. But unfortunately, you know, we're put on the defense, right? As people that it's kind of like, oh, you have to explain why, you know, like, for example, there was this video I made about this individual that was the first gay imam, and he kept saying it in the video. I didn't choose this. And it's true. The fact that you have to even say that is awful, because it's like, well, first of all, it shouldn't matter. Second of all, that's just proof that this makes no sense, right?
Yes, exactly. And it's like, it puts you in a strange predicament, or in a place of a position of disempowerment, you know, because you're explaining your soul to these people who are making you justify your soul.
Yes. You
know? And so it's really, it's a disempowering place to be, and you know, the argument, I completely agree with you, you know, and there's really that argument is an old argument. We're born that way, but it was such a good argument. It's such a strong argument when you're in that place.
Yeah,
you know, it's such a strong argument, because, you know, how can you argue against that, you know? But you know that, and you know, Muslims will try and you know, turn it back on you, and you know, make you, you know,
feel guilty,
lying, or that you're, you know, that you're, you know, you just want to sin and you just want to go against Allah and all. There's just, or the one that frustrated me the most was, this is a test from Allah, and those were coming from the quote unquote the compassionate Muslims, you know, and you sit and you think, well, okay, so. You think, you know, my worst enemy, I wouldn't, you know,
wishes on them.
Put them in this kind of test.
Yeah.
You know, especially if I'm all powerful, especially if I have the ability to not make it this way.
Yeah.
You know, and you think, and you're like, well, it's kind of cruel. It's very narcissistic, you know, to create your creation this way, knowing that life is suffering. So Allah, you know, created this, the heavens and the earth and everything in between, and he made the terms and conditions of this world to be full of suffering, and then he puts you in this place of suffering without your consent, because I didn't ask to come here. I didn't ask, you know, to be created this way. I didn't ask to be created, period. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, he's testing to see what, how much pain I'll be in, how much blood I can pour out. It's cruel. It's cruel.
Yeah. And this is kind of one of the biggest arguments against, I guess, a compassionate God, I would say, in general, because there's so many things in nature, and this is actually one example, the argument you made is an argument that goes against why would God make something forbidden and also make us this way. If you go even deeper than that, and we just look at suffering in general, what is the point of all of the unnecessary suffering in the world? This is actually a big problem for theology in general, that there is no real good answer to this, right? And so it ends up looking like more and more that to people that study, that religion was invented in order to make sort of to justify, it's like a post hoc rationalization that, oh, this is why we suffer, because it's something better for us, right? And this is a test. And like you said, what the fact that it's so unfair that you would have to go through this test and no other Muslim has to go through this test, and they're all like, they get to like satisfy their desires and get married to someone of the opposite gender sex, which is what they would want anyways, whereas you're expected to just like never, you know, fulfill your desire for love, all of these things. And it just doesn't make any sense that God does this. And you know, I totally empathize with that.
Yeah, because I used to think, well, you know, it's not like God, it's not like I'm being, you know, if God asked me to stay away from wine, for example, okay, sure, I don't need wine. It's not a physical need. It's not a, you know, biological need, you know.
Yeah.
But he happened to, you know, forbid me from accessing or pursuing the one thing on earth that is fantastic. The only one of the, you know, there's what's higher than love?
Yeah.
Nothing is higher than love.
Yeah.
And so he created me and then has forbid me to pursue love, you know, and that was cruel. But in terms of the way I dealt with it, so for many, 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 many years, I was, I chose to ignore it. So when I was, you know, I've known since I was like six,
mm-hmm.
right? So I've known since then. But I would always tell myself that's a future muggin mm-hmm. to deal with, sort of, you know, a present muggin to deal with, because I was, you know, because the you know, my house was quite abusive, so the thing that I was dealing with was my mother, and she used Islam to abuse me, and she used Islam to abuse me, and unfortunately for me, Islam, you know, validated her twisted, you know, version of, you know, I'm your mother, you're my child, and our relationship has to be this way, because guess what? Allah ordained for it to be this way.
Yeah.
You know?
So like, growing up with your mom, like how was that? Like what happened? How was she using Islam to hurt you or to control you? Manipulate you. You mentioned she was quite narcissistic. So narcissistic people tend to, I've noticed this, I have someone in my life that was like this, they tend to use religion. It's one of the one of the most useful tools to a narcissist is religion, right?
Yeah, it's a perfect tool, particularly Islam. I'm not too familiar with Christianity and Judaism, but particularly it's my experience, particularly Islam's perfect. If you're a narcissist, it's fantastic, you know. It appeals to all the, you know, the rage and the anger and the ability to point fingers, you know, and virtue signal whilst abusing someone, and et cetera. I guess the first thing I'll say is, because people always accuse me of, you know, they're like, oh, you're not a psychologist, so who are you to diagnose your mother, like categorize her as a narcissist? And so I always say, look, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not diagnosing her. I use the term narcissism as a descriptive term.
Yeah.
So it describes a set of behaviors. And so for me, narcissism is a disease of the conscience. And there's, you know, two main components to a narcissist, almost always. Like the narcissists that I've dealt with throughout my life have always had these two characteristics, which is that they're extremely entitled, and they're also exploitative. Mm-hmm. Those two elements. And so my mother was that.
And so, they tend to be very moralistic too.
It's very moralistic. They also love playing the victim when it suits them. And so my mother did all the time. Growing up with her, it's funny because Islam and my mother, like I could never tell the difference between Allah, Muhammad, and my mother. So they were all vengeful, rageful, angry, very intent on punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So she would often, that saying, heaven lies underneath your mother's feet. That was her favorite lines of all time. And that other hadith where that man spoke to to Muhammad about the rank of father or fatherhood, and Muhammad said, it's your mother first.
Yeah. Your mother. Yeah.
And then the fourth place was your father.
Yeah.
She absolutely loved that. Her control was there was no limit to her control, and she used Islam to justify that. So as you would know in Islam, as a child, your direct access to heaven is your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever she's displeased with you, Allah is also displeased with you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no real boundaries as to what that, whether that's limitless or there's a specific context for it. In Islam, it's just, basically, if your mother's displeased with you, then Allah is going to be displeased with you. And I always thought that was very strange, because doesn't Allah know that there are mothers who are going to abuse their children?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Muhammad mm-hmm. know that? So why didn't they put extra measures to ensure that there is no child abuse, that mm-hmm. that these mothers don't abuse this power? Like, why would Allah give a human being absolute power over another human being,
mm-hmm.
and not be specific as to the responsibility of that power?
Even the whole physical abuse is allowed under Islam.
Yes,
for children, right? Like, you're allowed to discipline your kids if they don't pray, and
I thought, I think to myself, isn't it strange that Allah can be very specific about what I can do with my body, what I can and can't eat, what I can and can't drink, it's very specific, but somehow he's forgotten about child abuse. The thing that actually matters, like, he's forgotten about child abuse, because in Islam, there's no real concept of child abuse. It's as though children don't really exist beyond controlling, or beyond telling them about Islam, or beyond raising them as a Muslim.
Yeah, there's also no concept of almost spousal abuse, right? There's no concept of marital rape, because all of the things that we see in these ancient religions, they're just products of the time, right? Product of a warlord's mind, and whatever the values were at that time, they become legislated. Like, the whole bigotry against homosexuals, and it's completely a product of not just the time but also the place, because there were some societies who were much more civilized and you can say loving and accepting and tolerant, democratic, that existed even before Islam. But Islam, in that particular locality, everything bad about what was there, and some, to be fair, some good things added, but all of the bad things were like became set in stone as well. And Muhammad made them like there till the end of time, basically, right? So forever and ever now, whatever was in his head, for example, the whole antagonism against Jews and Christians, because he was fighting with them, now it's instilled in the Quran to this day. You know, this hadith that say, like, don't say assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, to a non-Muslim, because supposedly there was a Jew that said death be on you. So now you have to say wa alaikum and to you, instead of wa alaikum salam and to you peace. Yeah. It's like the craziest thing. Like one bad apple supposedly ruined the entire Muslim civilization forever and ever. Like nobody abrogated that. Like they abrogated like other things, but this one just continued forever and ever.
Yeah, you just, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize, oh, this was just, it can't be from God. You know, Muhammad was not a prophet.
Yeah.
You know, if the message was from God, you know, you'd think God, Allah, would find a better method to sort of, you know, reveal himself to us. And, you know, you think, well, if Allah just revealed himself, it would just end all the confusion and all the debating and all of this. But he seems to not want to reveal himself for whatever reason. And he revealed himself in a language that was not mine, you know, and and you have to know this language to supposedly connect with him. And, you know, and that language was conveniently, you know, Muhammad's language. And it's just, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize, oh, you know.
Brother, but then, why are you making excuses? This is Allah's language. You have to take the effort to learn Allah's language. Yeah. This is why the Ummah is in such a state. We don't care about Allah, and we care about these kafir languages like English and Chinese and stuck for Allah. This is why. But yeah, it's you're right. It is a huge red flag.
It's just, you know, it's like hiding in plain sight. It's like, you know, the more you see, you can't unsee it.
Yeah,
you know, you see one thing, you cannot unsee it. You know, and
you can't put the genie back in the bottle.
No, you cannot. You cannot.
So, like, maybe we could talk about, you know, growing up, what were the challenges you had with Islam, and how did you overcome these challenges?
Yeah, so like I said, I grew up Salafi, and so I tried really hard to, you know, for a long time I believed in this stuff. You know, I just thought, oh, if I be a good Muslim, then somehow somehow Allah will accept me, and somehow Allah will change me, and deluded myself into thinking that I wasn't gay for a long period. But, you know, it's just my nafs, and my nafs is like pulling me away from Allah, and, you know, that's all it is. And the more I pray, and the more I, you know, follow Allah's way and Muhammad's way, then I'll be fixed. Because, you know, they promise you that if you follow Allah and his Rasul, then you will be happy. You will find contentment. You will find peace. You know, they promise you that.
Yeah, the Quran says in the remembrance of Allah is, you know, rest and contentment or something like that, right? Yeah.
Right.
And whoever forgets Allah, Allah forgets them, and blah, blah, blah.
exactly. So, you know, so I kind of practiced it. You know, I was a practicing Muslim for a long while. But then it got, you know, my abusive mother got more intense, and then I'm sort of looking for answers. I'm looking for a way to deal with her, and I'm looking for Islam to protect me, right? Because Allah was capable of, you know, forbidding things that didn't really matter, things that didn't really affect me. You know, it was very specific. And I'm just looking for textual. All I'm looking for is Allah and Muhammad to say child abuse is wrong. That's all I'm looking for. I'm looking for it, and I can't find it. And then I'm thinking, oh, maybe it's because I don't know Arabic. I can't speak Arabic. You know, maybe because I'm not learned enough. You know, I'm not a scholar. Maybe I have to go to a scholar and get an answer. And then, of course, Allah will then, you know, I'll learn that, yeah, Allah and Muhammad are against this, and I can use this as a way to protect myself. And so just to go back a little bit, you know, when before I turned 15, you know, with my mother's abuse, you know, it was really bad. You know, it was physical abuse, emotional abuse, you know, spiritual abuse. However, because before you're 15, you're not held accountable for your sins, I felt comfortable enough to dislike what she was doing. I was able to at least see, my God, what she's doing to you is wrong. I was able to hate it.
Nice.
But the moment I turned 15, I realized, I was like, oh, okay, well, now that I'm an adult, you know, because abusers make you think that they're abusing you because you've done something wrong. And because, you know, if your mother's displeased with you, that means Allah and his Rasulullah displeased with you.
Yeah.
Turn 15, now this sin, this responsibility is on me.
Yeah, it says as long as they're not compelling you to do something sinful, you have to obey them, even in like ridiculous stuff they make you do.
Right, exactly.
Because apparently, like, there's also, you just reminded me, there's another hadith that says that, like, you, no matter how much you do, you can never pay her back for like bailing you for 9 months or whatever.
Yeah. Which again reminds me so much of Allah, because Allah has allegedly brought me to this world. I never asked him to, but I have to thank him all the time. I never asked him to bring me here. I never came to him.
Yeah.
But I have to thank him all the time, and I have to remember that he brought me to this place of suffering. Yeah. And likewise, my mother, she would often use that. She would often use, you know, I gave birth to you, I carried you for 9 months, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, it was always like, well, I didn't choose this. You chose to become a parent.
Do you, just as a side question, do you feel like the world is, like, where you are in life now, do you feel like you're still happy that you were born and, like, life is getting better and you feel positive about it, even though none of us chose to be here? There's a growing, I've seen a growing movement of anti-natalists, people that, they're like, oh, I don't believe in childbirth and I don't believe in having kids and I don't believe that it should be the, I mean, it's kind of a paradox. How would you ever give, how would you get consent from someone before having them? It's like, you can't really do that, right?
Yeah, you can't. Well, look, I am appreciative that I exist.
Yeah.
Because on the other end, I recognize that existence is, you can make meaning out of your own suffering.
Yeah.
You know, make meaning out of life. You can go on this whole journey of, you know, provided you have the civil liberties and the freedom to do it, you know, you can make meaning out of your life, and life can be good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, life is hard, and there are all these challenges, but life is good. You know, life can be really beautiful. And I do want to become a parent one day, you know, so I do want to have kids with which I, it's a choice that I will make, and, you know, without their consent,
that's awesome. Yeah, no, glad to hear that. I mean, there's definitely a dark part of everyone's journey that goes through this, where it gets worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
And sometimes, especially depending on the situation and how much autonomy and freedom and where you live, I mean, you're lucky you're in Australia, I'm lucky I'm in Canada, we can actually talk about these things. Some people that are in Pakistan, for example, they message me, they often are like, I need to get out of here, I need sponsorship, and I'm like, you're gonna have to work your dig your way out of this hole, because there's no way out other than if you do it yourself and work hard. And, you know, and so some of us are more privileged that we have this opportunity to be. And how did you protect yourself from your parental, like, all of that negativity? Did you eventually leave the home? Like, what happened?
Yeah, no, so I sort of just like, took the abuse. You know, when you're like children who experience the kind of abuse that I did, you know, narcissistic abuse, you know, in order to survive, what you do is you kind of delude yourself into thinking, like, in my case, I deluded myself into thinking, no, my mother loves me.
Mm.
It's all me. I'm the problem. I need to be fixed. I need to change, you know. And the quicker I change, she's going to stop this behavior, you know, because I'm making her do this. But for me, the more I submitted, again, reminds me of Islam, the more I submitted, the worse it got. because you know in Islam you can be the best Muslim ever, follow all the rules, you can't even think you're going to go to heaven. You might go to heaven, you can't, because who the hell are you? Only Allah knows who's going to go to heaven. Who the hell are you? You know, and it was sort of similar with my mother. It was a black hole. You know, the more I submitted, the worse she got, and the more entitled she felt. So I just, years of delusion, years of kind of separating myself from my own reality just to get by. And I did that until about 2012, where I was like, hold on, things aren't right. You know, things aren't getting better. Yeah, at this point, I had left Salafism, Wahhabism, and I tried to, I went on to become a Tablighi. For those who don't know what Tablighis are, basically, they're like the Muslim versions of missionaries. They basically go to different Muslim houses to, like, invite them to practice Islam and remind them of Allah. And so they somehow get all the address of all the, whatever area they're in, they collect all the Muslim house addresses, and then they go visit all the Muslim households. And so I had met this Muslim guy who was a Tablighi. He was less, I don't know, intense compared to what I knew, which was with the Wahhabis, less about politics, less about violence, less about taking over the world, less about you know all this sort of stuff, which kind of appealed to me, because I was like, oh, okay, so he's not talking about the kafirs in this way all the time, and he's not like political in the sense that it's all like conspiracy based, you know, the kafirs are all doing, they're all doing this, and
yeah,
we've got to do this in order to, you know, to overthrow the kafirs, and you know. And so, I became Tablighi, and I did that, and slowly.
Did you stay at the mosques?
I would. So they would. I didn't go as far as, because they would recommend, which I found a bit strange. They would recommend to go to India once in your lifetime. To do some sort of like Tablighi thing. I can't remember what it was, but it was one, and it just sounded very much like their version of the of Hajj.
Daula or something.
I can't look at as many as
it's like a big gathering,
which they do. And I would go to the mosque. There was a mosque in not far from where I lived, with which all the Tablighis used to congregate, and I would go there, and some weekends go away with them and do this whole Tablighi thing. And I remember basically the straw that broke the camel's back, because I always had the luxury of thinking, of like questioning things within myself, and just like things that this doesn't feel right. It just feels strange. And so I had so many of those like feelings throughout my journey of being Muslim. But anyway, I remember one of these days I was out with this Tablighi group, and we had traveled to Tasmania. And we were going to this Muslim family's house. And then one of the guys I was with, we were just talking about something trivial. I think it was about cars or whatever it was. And then there was like this person who walked past us. And this guy just randomly said the Shahada really loud as this person was walking past us. And I was like, wait, what? What just happened? What? I was so confused. I was like, what? And he's like, oh, look, you know, the reason why I did this was so this person on the day of judgment, they can't say that they didn't hear the Shahada. So at that point, it was basically a straw that broke the camel's back, because I was like, what? I'm like, bro, you realize, first of all, you're assuming this person's not Muslim, number one. You don't know. Number two, if they're not Muslim, then they're not going to understand what the hell you're saying. To them, completely gibberish. Just complete crap to them. It's just like, it just sounds to them, right?
So like this person would go to hell supposedly if this guy was right.
And that's my third point. So I was like, you're working towards making them go to hell.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Why? I just thought that was evil. I just thought that was evil. And at that point, I was like, okay, I can't. They're just like the Wahhabis, the Salafis. Like, you pull back the curtain and it's exactly the same. It's a condemnation and it's, you know, judgment and, you know, purity and virtue signaling. And yeah, so I after that trip, I was like, yeah, I'm sort of done with Tablighis. And then I was like in this sort of no man's land when it comes to Islam. And then I came across a lecture by Hamza Yusuf, one of his old lectures. And I remember this lecture was titled, Your Parents, You Have to Love Them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which was automatically a trigger for me because it was like, here we go again. Because I always got the messages again, you know, you have to be, your parents are absolved from any kind of responsibility. You can't hold your parent to account because they're basically God. And so I remember hearing, you know, reading this topic and I was like, oh, here we go again. It's more of the same crap. But then I pressed play and I started listening to the lecture, and Hamza Yusuf started with, he basically said to them, look, I know the topic of this, you know, of this lecture, but in the title of this lecture, I understand it, but sometimes he said, it's hard to love your parents. And I was like,
wow.
Who is this scholar who's speaking like this? What? So I basically listened to all of his, like, I became obsessed with Hamza Yusuf's teaching because I thought, oh my God, a Muslim scholar who's in defense of children, who's speaking truth, you know, against this. This is powerful. So I went on this journey and I became through his lectures, I became a Sufi. The thing that was really powerful for me coming from where I came from in terms of the whole Salafi stuff was, you know, Sufis were talking about the, you know, the spirit of Islam, you know. It was so lovely to me, you know. I'm like, oh, here are Muslims who are talking about compassion and they're into philosophy, because I've always been into philosophy and ideas, you know, and yeah, learning about Imam Al-Ghazali and
yeah,
and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, oh wow, this is amazing. I'm like, oh, I found my place in the Muslim world. This is amazing. And then I applied for, he has a program, I don't know if he starts his program, but he's
Rihla.
The Rihla.
Yeah.
Yes. So I applied for the Rihla. This is probably about 2011, I think it was. I applied for the Rihla, and that year they were at Turkey. I applied for it, I got into it, and I was like over the moon. I fly to Turkey and, you know, to do the program, and I get there and it's Turkey was amazing. It was beautiful. It was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. But I get there and, you know, it's great. You know, I met Hamza Yusuf and, you know, I would tell him, you know, how much his lectures changed my life and all that sort of stuff. But slowly and surely I started to see that Sufism was just the covert version of Wahhabism. And also, I never understood the hatred between Salafis and Sufis between each other. I never understood why there was so much animosity between between those groups. And so I go on to the program, it was about 6 weeks, and halfway through the program, I'm just thinking, oh man, you know, the people are the same. People are, you know, they have their us and them, us versus them mentality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not really grappling with the contradictions. So I'm seeing all these Sufis talk about compassion and Rahman and all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, you know, apostates are punishable by death. You know, homosexuals are meant to be killed. And they're not grappling with this. They're not dealing with this. Because I thought that they had found a way to make it make sense.
Yeah.
You know, and they acted as if they did. And so I thought they did. And I'm slowly realizing, no, they haven't. And then again, another, you know, moment, you know, it was a straw that broke the camel's back was at a lecture with Hamza Yusuf, you know, and he was teaching. And he had, and he went on this tirade about how men shouldn't wear t-shirts because it's a Western clothing and we should wear like Islamic clothing. And there was a whole lecture based on that where it was berating men for wearing t-shirts. And I was sitting there thinking, Hamza Yusuf, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there thinking, bruh, did I fly all the way here? You shouldn't wear a t-shirt? What?
Uh-huh.
What's going on? I'm like, oh my God. So I'm sitting there just absolutely mortified, and it just dawned upon me that it was the same crap. And I'm just sitting there in a foreign country, and I'm just like looking at this man who's just, you know, who like chose to be Muslim.
Sorry. So it's like a cult, right?
Yes.
It feels
yes.
like it. Like, oh my God, what am I in?
Very much so. I'm looking around and no one seems to be reacting to this. Like, no one's reacting to this insane
statement,
you know, commentary. Yeah, yeah, about something so arbitrary. And that's a sign of a cult when they like problematize something arbitrary that's just nothing. Because the t-shirt's amoral. It's nothing immoral moral about a t-shirt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm just looking around, I'm thinking, oh my God, like, am I the only one that's like bothered by this? And eventually finished the lecture and I just like stopped attending the classes at that point. You know, I was like, you know, I'll make the rest of this a holiday and I'll just, you know, I'll just stop attending this stuff because it's not. So I went to Turkey, you know, I went to the Rihla,
yeah,
knowing where I was going to be in terms of being Muslim.
Yeah,
I came back utterly confused about where the hell I belong. What the hell was this? I had come back and I was like, yeah, this is all the same crap. It's all the same crap. and they haven't dealt with, and the, you know, the Sufis haven't dealt with these core questions about Islam. They haven't dealt with it. They just love to explain it away, you know, in a more musical way. But it's the same.
Yeah, because apparently Allah has more mercy than a calf that's to a little baby or something, like, and yet he throws people in hell and he made people for hell. The hadith also says he literally, like, Adam has a bunch of sons or offspring that are all going to hell. He has a bunch that are all going to heaven. And it's like decreed from the beginning of time, all these people are going to hell. And it's like, well, why did you make them then? Like, what was the point of, like, if you own a factory, and you have a 1% to 5% failure rate of like making phones or something, that's all waste. But Allah has like an 80% failure rate, then 80% of the world. In fact, if you include like the fake Muslims, the ones that don't pray, the wrong sect, the Shias, the Ahmadis, the Salafis, the Tabligh, whichever one's wrong, all of them except the one.
Yeah.
It's probably like close to 95% is going to hell. So what kind of God is this that put 95% of his creation in hell? And we're talking about like billions upon billions upon billions every generation that just like food for the fire, right?
It's absolutely crazy. And you just think, well, what the hell do you do with that? What the hell do you do with that? You know, because the chances of you going to hell are pretty high. And you know, if you're an observer, if you're a Muslim who's taking, you know, their religion seriously, you can't help but think that.
You
can't help but think that.
It's a mental, cognitive, like, it's the guilt that you constantly feel guilty. You constantly feel anxiety about, you know, the day of judgment and all of these things. And by the way, before we continue, just for 1 second, I just want to remind everyone to, I'm just going to do a YouTube thing, and please don't forget to like and subscribe. This helps the channel and it helps give visibility to the work that we do, and it is most appreciated. You can also consider joining on Patreon or clicking join now below on the channel itself. So just a little ad break and then back to what we were saying.
Yeah. You can't help but think. You know, if you are someone who takes this seriously, you can't help but think, oh man, my chances of going to heaven are pretty slim here. So I've got to do whatever I can to get there. You know.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, there was this hadith. You know, I think it was Umar or one of the big Sahabis who used to wish to be a bird, you know, because a bird is what was it? Because a bird was not going to be held accountable, was not aware of itself, you know. And I used to resonate with that. I used to be like, well, why did Allah create me as a person? You know, I wish I was a tree instead, or a bird instead. You know, because I could avoid hell. You know, and I you know, that's really bad. But you know, the us versus them mentality that's just steeped in Islam is really, to me, one of the really bad elements of the faith, because you know, even in hell, the believers are laughing at the people who are in hell, whether they're believers or not, because they're laughing at them. And you just think again, like, what kind of God would set up would make this the kind of setup? And I, you know, and I thought there was no envy and no nothing bad in heaven. So why are these people laughing at, you know, the people who are in hell? And
yeah, I wanted to make a video on this weird psychological twisted state that you end up in, because if you're truly like a human being, you know, you have empathy. Some of us, most of us, I mean, not obviously not psychopaths, but most of us have empathy for others. And like you said, you wouldn't wish some of these things on your worst enemy, yet apparently you got everything you wanted. Now you're like become a zombie and you're laughing at people that are in hell, and they're going to ask you for water. They're going to be like, no, taste the punishment that Allah gave you. Like, it's like some robot. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, we can laugh about it now because it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just absolutely ridiculous. And there's no way this is true. And there's no, it's just.
Yeah. You know, sorry, one more thing. When I first left Islam and I had my sister-in-law come over and she was telling me about hell, you're going to go to hell. And she started crying and I almost started laughing. And I wasn't trying to be mean, but to me, someone that's like, you're outside of this, you can see how fake it is. Yeah. And someone's inside it. It's like a little kid crying over, you know, something silly. Like, it was like, I'm not going to hell. Like, why are you crying? I'm going to be fine. I'm just fine. But it's like, you're right. When you're in that, like, to her, this was a trauma that I'm going to go to hell now. And I think some of my family members, I mean, luckily my family is pretty liberal, so I don't have this problem overall with like most of my immediate family members, but there are family members that definitely at some point, maybe they've accepted it now, but they definitely felt like shame that this is my like relative that's making YouTube videos talking about Islam, you know, anger as well. There's also the whole like, you know, sadness, this guy's gonna go to hell. It's like, yeah, how do you help people like that, right?
Yeah, you can't. I've always been curious to know, because I've had similar experiences, you know. Had this Sufi friend. Mm-hmm. We're not friends anymore, but you know, he we sort of reconnected a couple of years ago, and he found out I left Islam, and you know, and he was trying to convert me back to Islam. But the thing is, I didn't realize he was doing that because he never made it clear. And so he, you know, the first thing he did was he told me something personal that happened to him, you know, something really bad that happened to him, that certain Muslims did to him, as a way to sort of as a way to make me think, oh, you know, I know your mother abused you and stuff like that, but you know, you know, Muslims have also abused me, but I haven't left Islam. And, you know, he just didn't understand that, you know, a person can leave Islam for reasons other than abuse. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't leave because of the abuse. I left because I realized that Allah and Muhammad were not true.
Yes.
That's why I left. Otherwise, I would have stayed. It's not because I didn't leave because of the abuse. I was looking for a way to... trying to find out if Muhammad and Allah would protect me and mm-hmm. you know, give me textual evidence that I could.
Yeah. You know what? This is peak gaslighting. Because it's like they're trying to make you sound, I got gaslit as well, right? When I left Islam, and the gaslighting they did on me was, you didn't want to pray and fast.
Yeah.
Like after 15 years of me being super religious, the whole 15 years, until the very end, when I finally realized it was false and I just left it, I did everything. Like, what do you mean I didn't want to? Like, if I didn't want to, I just would be a sinful Muslim. Like, you don't have to leave Islam to be a sinful Muslim. You could be like, okay, I'll be a sinful Muslim. I'll be a gay Muslim even. Like, you know, Allah might forgive me, whatever. You make a cognitive, you have your cognitive dissonance, everybody does. You leave because you realize that it's false and you don't want to be a part of this anymore. Not because you want to sin, right? It's gaslighting.
That's exactly it. And so he didn't, you know, when it dawned upon me that he was trying to convert me back to Islam, I said to him, look, I grew up with abuse and stuff like that, but I didn't leave because of the abuse. I left because this religion is not true. It's false. It's false. So, you know, I take or leave it, but that's just what it is. And I don't know about you, like, you know, if you ever experienced this, but I know for me, like the Muslims that I grew up with who knew me really well, in the religious circles, once I left Islam, they started speaking to me as if I was never Muslim, and that I didn't know Islam, and I just didn't know what I knew, you know. So they would like try and define certain things, you know, and they'll try and teach me, you know, Islam says you have to pray 5 times a day and stuff like that. And I was like, you've known me my entire life. What?
Yeah. What? Did anyone ever tell you you were never a true Muslim or something like that? Did you hear that?
Not in person. No, not in person. Online, you know, online trolls, you know, have, you know, just the other day, there were some online trolls who were telling me that I'm not Somali because I left Islam, that you can't be both Somali and an ex-Muslim.
Yeah.
Somehow Islam is a part of my DNA. And
yeah, I do wish, and it's not going to happen anytime soon, that Islam, like being Muslim, wasn't like a theological claim, was a more flexible, relaxed theological, it was more like a cultural claim than a theological claim. And then no one cares anymore. Like, yeah, I'm Muslim, I don't really believe. Yeah, I might go to the mosque, I might not go to the mosque. I don't really believe in this thing. Just like you see in other cultures, like cultural Christians, cultural Jews. Like it's like we have to make a statement now. We're like, we're ex-Muslim. I'm not Muslim. I'm away from Islam. Like we have to do this to kind of like fix the problem that there's no room for nuance in Islam. It's like either you're completely Muslim or you're not Muslim. There's no like wishy-washy Muslim, which I do wish that was the case, because that would make it easier. And I do think over time that's what's going to happen anyways. We're going to see more and more and more Muslims. But then again, we don't know. Yeah. Fundamentalism can always come back. And there's always a risk with this Muhammad Hijab and Ali Dawah and all these people, Eddie Dean show. They're always pulling people into fundamentalism, right? So we can't ever take it for granted.
Right. It's funny because, you know, Islam and Muslims hate, you know, being wishy-washy when it comes to Islam. But the thing that I learned was, after I left Islam, I realized even the Wahhabis were all of a sudden wishy-washy in terms of what the real Islam is. All of a sudden now I'm hearing, for example, Aisha wasn't 6 when Muhammad married her. It was 12, 15, she was 12, 15, 18, whatever it is. You know, I'm like, wait, what? When I was Muslim, this is something you were completely unapologetic about.
Yes, it's changing now, right?
What's going on? You know, all of a sudden it's changed. You know, and you know women wearing hijab. It's a, you know, when I was growing up, it was not a choice. Women had to wear the hijab. It was an obligation from Allah, and there was no ifs or buts about it. And the women and girls that didn't wear it, they were going to hell. So that was just what it was. And then when I left Islam, all of a sudden it's like, no, women have a choice, and you know, it's a journey. The hijab's a journey, you know. And I'm like, when did I miss this like flip floppy Islam, because it would have made my life easier.
You know, it's funny. We actually made a video about hijab being a journey. My new wife, and I worked on this video together. I didn't even know about this whole hijab's a journey thing, but she told me about it, and I was like, whoa, I didn't know about this. That's interesting. Yeah, it's a journey, but never comes back on once it's off. Apparently,
right. It's a journey so long as you get there.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a journey to realize, oh, hold on, maybe it's not for me.
Yeah.
Maybe this thing is
oppressive.
Maybe it's taking away my right to express myself how I want to. Maybe it's just taking away my choice to not wear it, you know? And that's the thing about Islam. It's like when I was going through my questioning phase, you know, and I sort of opened up to certain Muslims, and, you know, and the message that I kept on getting was, okay, my man, if you're hell bent on questioning Islam,
hell bent.
yeah. That was basically what it was. You know, if you're hell bent on questioning Islam, then get to a point where you don't cross the line of leaving Islam. You can question as much as you want, so long as you come to the conclusion of Islam. You come to the same conclusion as Muhammad and Allah.
Yeah.
It's fine. You know.
You know, this is funny. I have to say something. As you may or may not know, I used to be an Ismaili Muslim. Ismailis, okay, so you knew this. So Ismailis are Sunnis, including me, would say they're not Muslim. I mean, including me as a Muslim, I also said Ismailis are not Muslim. And the reason I said that is because the theology is very, very different from mainstream Sunni Islam. They believe a lot of weird things about Aga Khan, okay? So I consider them non-Muslim. So I considered, because the religion was so different, that I converted from Ismailism to Sunnism. Even if I didn't convert into Islam, if you want to consider I was a Muslim, I just changed sects. I still changed from a fake version of Islam.
Right.
Sorry, Ismailis, to a real version of Islam. I'm not saying that now as an atheist. I don't care at all.
Yeah.
They're all interpretations of Islam. But anyway, so the Sunni one is more based. Anyway, whatever. The point is, I would ask them, I'm like, so you guys were very happy that I was questioning and I left Islam, left Ismailism and I became Sunni. You were very happy. And I had someone tell me the exact same thing as you. It's okay to question, but I'm like, that didn't work for me, my previous religion. Why now? Now you want me to suddenly stop questioning after this questioning led me to the truth of Islam.
Right.
Now the questioning is leading me out of Islam. Now you have a problem with it.
Yeah, it's I don't even know how to describe that. It's so weird, because I don't know about you. I felt like when I heard that, I felt like I was being imprisoned in a way. I was like, oh, wait, what? I'm on this journey, and there's this like major stop sign. You know, you can't go past this stop sign. It's like, well, why? It makes no sense. You know, but it's again the hypocrisy of Islam. You know, Islam is superior to that, to everything else. You know, so of course, how could you not come to the same conclusion as Islam? Because it's the ultimate truth. You know,
that's right. Like, you have to come to that conclusion because that's the only true conclusion.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, I have a Somali Muslim friend that actually is still friends with me, actually, believe it or not. And he used to tell me that there's only two options here. One, Islam is false and I deserve to know. Or two, Islam is true, so I'm not scared of like hearing what you have to say, because it's like, what does the truth have to fear from like falsehood, right, or whatever, right? The Quran says that, like, truth destroys falsehood or whatever, you throw it at it and whatever. So he was like, this is how I want Muslims to be. It's like open-minded, intellectually curious, and like able to have these conversations and dialogue, because the better argument, the better idea is going to win at the end of the day. So you shouldn't be scared of the dark, right? You shouldn't be scared of the truth is always going to be there, right? But this is another form of kind of gaslighting again, where when Muslims are expecting you to only question up to a certain point, when they say that you have to be like a scholar, you have to talk to a scholar, or you have to be knowledgeable in Arabic. Suddenly, like when I convert, it's funnier for someone like me, because I saw what the reaction when I became Muslim, right? Became Sunni. And I saw the reaction when I left it, and it's like, it's totally inconsistent. Like, they should be like, you know, well done for thinking, even though you're wrong. But no, there's no more stop. It literally what you said, stop thinking.
Yeah.
Stop. Like, actually was actually told, stop thinking, stop questioning. I'm like, yeah. What?
Yeah. I think that's, for me, that's one of the evil things about Islam, is because to me, like, the thing that makes us human is our ability to think. It's literally our ability to think.
That's true.
You know, and we can't think without speaking. It's virtually impossible. And so Islam, you know, demands that you kind of suspend your thinking.
Your intellect. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to suspend it and turn it into submission. You know, so that's a trade-off that it expects you to make. But, you know, I think it's cruel, you know, to expect us to do that. But I experienced the same thing, and it was very odd. And coming to people who like converted, I remember when I was Muslim and someone would convert, it was like this whole thing, you know, a person would convert and all it takes is just to say the Shahada. There was never any kind of real process of, you know, ensuring this person understands what Islam means and all that sort of stuff. And so there'd be all this love bombing. Like, you know, the congregation would like just rush over to this individual who's converted to Islam. And it was crazy. It was like, I'd often feel like, oh, well, this is a lot. And it was a lot. And, you know, but then when you leave Islam, it's like the all of a sudden, you know, you're ignorant. You can't read, you don't know Arabic. So who are you to even speak about Islam? You know, there's all these things that you need to do. You need to become a scholar. You need to know, you know, Fusha Arabic in order to really understand the Quran, and then to be able to leave the religion. And it's like, well, no, I don't, because I grew up Muslim, and there's just certain things you just on a fundamental level you can leave without even knowing the entire religion. Like, just the concept of hell and who goes to hell is enough for someone to just leave. It's enough.
Yeah. Yeah. It's inherently, I always connected back to the fact that like 80-90% of humanity then is going to hell, which makes it completely incompatible with the compassion of God. Also, what would be the point of hell? It doesn't reform anyone, because it's final. It's not like you're teaching anyone anything. Again, it seems all too convenient as a control tactic rather than something that's actually, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, I personally believe, and some people don't understand this argument, but there is no such thing as free will, and that we are all products of an environment and the genetics, and we have the illusion of free will, but we're going to do what we're going to do. And like, if I was like, say, for example, living in Saudi Arabia, my same me, I maybe would have never left Islam. Maybe, I don't know, because I wouldn't have been exposed to like critical thinking. And so the same me in India, for example, growing up among Hindus, there's no way I would have become Muslim, probably. And maybe there's this 1% chance. But so like, because there's only one way to go, why would people be punished for that? It's like God should be punished for not putting them in the environment where they ended up, where he wanted them to be. And then, there's so many things about hell. When I first left Islam, I made a post about hell. And one of the Muslims that knew me was like, you're just trying to be emotional and make an emotional argument against Islam. But there's nothing wrong with making people think about like emotion. We have emotions for a reason. It's to guide us for self-preservation, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. But the irony of that is Islam is all emotional. when people convert to Islam, they don't convert for intellectual reasons for the most part. They convert for emotional reasons. Something's happening in their life and they want more meaning and they convert, but these Muslims never question, never problematize that.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Yeah, like, yeah, even in the comments here, like Little Missy is saying Islam is a very rational religion. I think it has the PR of a rational religion, but when you start digging into it, it starts the holes that appear everywhere. So you know, when I first left Islam, it was quite a journey, and I started off by asking questions about the Quran. I'm like, well, what about this in the Quran and this hadith? And you know, I have these problems. So I was like, my friend hooked me up with a sheikh, a Sufi sheikh. He's like, he'll help me walk me through these problems. I was like really excited, just like you. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be Muslim. And then I went with the questions, and it was like, he didn't have answers to them. Like, of course, these people don't have answers to these things because they don't study these things, because they study what they study, which is how to do wudu and whatever, right? Like the proofs of Islam they have are like Muhammad won at Badr with angels or something. Like that's the arguments. Like, okay, like that's not going to convince me, right? But this guy was like, it's kind of funny. He's like, I've converted 13 atheists or something. Like, I was like, wow, like this is cool. I'm excited, right? And I'm like, you converted them to Muslim or to what? It's like, yeah, they believe in God, but not Islam. I'm like, you convince them to be deist. Like, that's not why I'm here. Like, I want proof of Islam, right? But like, yeah. I realized that there's a whole like perspective that has to be different. What I mean to say is, when someone is like trying to tell you what are the problems you have with Islam, that questioning is already framed in the wrong way in order to put you into a trap. Mm-hmm. The reality is, you should prove to me why Islam is true. Yeah. Not why do I have problems with Islam. No, you tell me why I should believe in it. And right. If you look at it from that perspective, it gets less and less believable. There's not that many good, there's no good arguments. But what I'm saying is, why do I have to defend why I disbelieve? It's the other way around. You need to convince me. The proof of burden is on the one making the claim. Is you proving, you're trying to say Islam is true. Prove it's true, right? Where's your evidence?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, the other trap they try and get you in is getting you to prove that Allah doesn't exist, for example. It's like, how can you prove something that doesn't exist?
Yeah, like Russell's teapot, right? The analogy, there's a teacup flying around the moon or something. It's like, well, prove it. Like, or prove there's no three-headed unicorn that's like going to eat you when you die or something. Like, you can't prove it, right?
Right. You can't. So it's like, well, you know, it's just not true. It just doesn't exist. And then again, if Allah existed, why did he put it in a book form? Couldn't he have thought of a better way to do this? Because, you know, us weak humans have thought of, if you have created all this amazing technology, mm-hmm. you know, but he is unable to do that somehow for whatever reason. And I always used to think about as well, all the, you know, ridiculous miracles that Muhammad allegedly performed. You know, you think, why were they so lucky to witness these miracles? Why has Allah just gone quiet since then?
Yeah, it's unfair.
Yeah.
It's really unfair. And also, like, you know, the best example of a Muslim, according to Islam, is Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr just blindly believed. His friend's like, I'm a prophet. He's like, okay, I believe you. Like, that's the level of, like, that's the level of skepticism you're expected to have as a Muslim. And he's considered the best Muslim ever, yeah. Right? Like, because he believed in Muhammad basically based on what? I don't know. Like, and then soon after becoming the prophet, he wanted to marry his little daughter. Yeah. I mean, if that's not a red flag, I don't know. Like, it's like, I'm the prophet. Give me your 6-year-old daughter right now. I had a dream about her. Like,
it's disturbing, you know. And I often thought, like, you know, their relationship just seemed very weird to me. You know, I just thought, sometimes I think, you know, how true is it the way that Muslims have documented their relationship? Like, did he really, like, you know, believe in him in that way, or was there some sort of deal between those two? You know, we'll never know. But, you know, one of the things that I thought was really, that never left me, even when I was Muslim, was Muhammad's relationship to his uncle, Abu Talib.
Abu Talib, the good one.
Yeah. Who protected him and who looked after him. And, you know, he still went to hell, you know, and he went to hell, even though he was a good, you know, human being who protected him and looked after him and all that sort of stuff. And which you know, sends a message that you can be the most amazing human being. You can give charity. You can, mm-hmm. you know, build an orphanage. You can do all these amazing things, but if you don't pledge your allegiance to Muhammad, which is the Shahada for me is like a form of pledging one's allegiance to,
yeah,
you know, a dictator. You know, yeah. If you don't pledge your allegiance to this dictator, then what you do is irrelevant.
Yeah, and it would be in real life the bay'ah. It was literally pledging allegiance, yes. Like literally, you're my boss now, and I have to do every single thing you say. Right. To the extent that Muhammad said he wanted to burn the houses of the people that didn't come pray Fajr, the men that didn't come pray Fajr. I mean, he didn't do it, but he was like that angry that they didn't. The whole religion is all about like making you brainwashed, right? And obey, and you got to love Muhammad more than your own family and your own self and your kids. And it's right. Very, very cult-like. It has cult programming in it, for sure. Oh,
absolutely. Without a doubt, you know, because you got to get rid of the self. There's no self. You're just an extension of Islam, and you're a tool to promote Islam, and that's all you are, you know. And it's very, very, very strange. But that Abu Talib story really, really affected me, you know, when I was Muslim, because I just thought, well, if he's going to hell, then what the hell? What? Why? Why, mate? It's just, you know, you can so the you know what it meant to be good didn't matter. You know, you can be an evil person, but if you pledge your allegiance to Islam and you have
get out of jail card.
Yes, you do. And I saw many Muslims operate that way. You know, many Muslims who didn't really care about Islam, but they use Islam to promote themselves. You know.
Mm-hmm. So moving on to like life after Islam, how would you say things have changed for you now that you finally, I don't know when exactly you actually formally left Islam? Was it a process? Was it just like you finally just one day you just said, no, I'm not Muslim anymore?
Yeah.
Then how has life changed since you've actually stopped caring about Islam?
Yeah. So for me, I wish it was just like one moment where I just woke up and I was like, you know what?
Yeah,
stuff all this, and I'm actually, you know, I wish it was like that, but no, it was an amalgamation of years of turmoil, years of processing, years of like getting rid of all the rots and opening myself up, and you know, really like acknowledging what my life was, you know, in the same way that like an addict, you know, would. And the first step is to always to acknowledge whatever issue. That was the process I kind of took. I had to reckon with my life. That was the very first step, you know. And so I did that. I got to a point where I was like, all right, life's not what it is. Islam's promises didn't come to be. You know, I'm not happy. I'm not content. I'm not all these things. So I went on a journey, and that journey started probably around 2012, 2013. Anyway, so I ended up like leaving Islam in 2020. But before that, like, I had stopped practicing at all. Like, I started fasting when I was 14, and then I stopped fasting when I was 28. And I just gradually stopped caring about the rules, the halals, the harams. So for a long time, you know, you could consider me an ex-Muslim for many, many, many years, but I formally like left in 2020, where I was like, you know what, I have to actually say this to myself. I can't be. Yeah, I went through the general process. I mean, I became, after the whole Salafi stuff, you know, Sufi stuff, I became a liberal Muslim. You know, and I was Muslim by name, but was doing everything that wasn't Muslim, you know. And then I left. And so life after Islam, you know, it was a process of like connecting with myself, you know. It was a process where I, you know, I got to a place where I could, you know, wake up as me, you know, leave my house as myself and maneuver through my day as me, you know, and then come back to my own place as me. And so it's been such a blessing to be able to live in my own authenticity, you know, and really grapple with life and try to figure out, you know, all right, now that I've left Islam, I can I can take on any idea I want. I can reject any idea I want. And then I have to go on this journey of like figuring out my own moral philosophy. I have to figure out, okay, well, what is good and what is bad? And, you know, how do I want to live my life, and how do I want to lead my life? You know what I mean? And so I've been on that journey and trying to make meaning out of all the suffering that I went through, which has been really, really rewarding and, you know, exhilarating and mortifying all at the exact same time. Because when when you feel like you've got no choices and you're in this religion that takes away your own agency, and then you leave, and then you're in this sea of, you all of a sudden have all this freedom, it can be overwhelming.
Yeah. You know, it's
like, whoa, what do I do? It's intoxicating, but at the same time, overwhelming. And then so, you know, I have to catch up on, you know, things that I've missed. You know, you sort of feel like you're behind, you know, you're like kind of playing catch up, and there's its own grief there as well. And, you know, so it hasn't been like perfect, you know, but life, as I see, you know, life is not perfect. Mm-hmm. It's going to be struggles, you know, and you've got to, you know, the goal is to be a well-adjusted human being, you know, and Islam doesn't provide that. It doesn't provide that. So, yeah.
Sounds good. Happy to hear that. And yeah, you do poetry, you wrote a book. So let's go through that one more time then before we end off. I'm going to share my screen. Yes. Tell us about your podcast again. So for those that missed it, Muggan has a podcast called Inner Self Rising Podcast. You want to tell us about that? I guess you can do it on any platform. This is just this is Apple, but it's available on all platforms, right?
Yeah. It's available on all platforms. And, you know, Inner Self Rising, I started, you know, many years ago. And initially it was a podcast to kind of explore narcissism, mm-hmm. and to kind of have that conversation and to connect with people who did experience narcissism. And then I realized there was lots of psychologists who specialize in this field who were talking about this. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's probably best for me to leave it for them, mm-hmm. for the experts to unpack, you know, what narcissism is. And it just became a big I don't know, movement, if you want to call it that. And so I felt like, oh, you know, I've got nothing really to contribute to it, other than my own experience. And so I just, you know, and then so I then transitioned out of that and, you know, decided to make the podcast about, you know, authenticity, you know, for free thinkers. And I wanted to connect with people I call outliers, you know, who have left their bubble of origin, you know, because they've thought for themselves, they don't align with the bubble of origin, or they were even kicked out. Because I want to speak with outliers. And so it's predominantly for free thinkers, you know, who are interested in self-development and living authentically, you know, because that's brought me so much meaning in my own life, and challenges as well, you know. And so I, you know, talk to people who I consider outliers, and other times I just me talking about, you know, whatever I feel like talking about. So a lot of ex-Muslim content as well. I tell my story on my podcast as well, which is on YouTube, by the way, as well.
So nice.
Yeah, Inner Self Rising on YouTube too. So yeah, I kind of tell my story as well in more detail, and yeah, that's
my podcast. Perfect. I will share your link right now. And now that I've seen it, okay, that's pretty awesome. I didn't realize you were on YouTube as well.
Yeah,
this is the one in a South.
Yeah, that's it. Yep, that's it.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I'll share that. I'll add that to the links. And do you want to talk about your book as well, finally, before we go?
Yes. So my book, Stop All the Clocks. I actually have a funny story, not funny, about my book, actually. So I had published a book prior to this back in 2018. And so my publisher at the time, my publisher who published that first book, just a little about him. He was like an extreme atheist. He was a Marxist, you know, an old white man, as they say it. And so he was anti-religion. And so I met him when I was studying, because I studied creative writing at university. and he was one of my teachers. And so I'd met him then, and then we had, you know, connected on poetry, and we had been working together since. When I met him, I was in the stage of questioning Islam. So I was sympathetic to certain kind of ideas like Marxism, postmodernism, all that sort of stuff. I was sympathetic to those ideas. And it sort of appealed to this side of me, that this void that I had. Anyway, so he was an extreme Marxist. So he published that first book. It's called From Grains to Gold, and it's a collection about grief. And I go through the five stages of grief in that collection. And so fast forward to stop all the clocks, he was set to publish this collection. But he ended up withdrawing from publishing this collection because, according to him, I was being Islamophobic. You know, in telling my story, I was being Islamophobic, and he accused me of being a right winger.
Wow.
Yeah, and so he ended up withdrawing from working from publishing this collection.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so he rejected. He grew up Christian, but he rejected Christianity. And so for him, he hates all religion, but he strangely gave Islam a special kind of consideration. And the way he justified his, you know, special status is given Islam is, you know, the Muslim world experienced colonialism.
The minority is something, right?
Yes. And so, you know, for him, it was, you know, for him, it was okay. He's allowed to question his religion, his culture, his background. You know, it's okay for him to do it. But me, it's not okay for me to do it because,
oh my goodness. You know,
I just thought it was quite racist, ironically, because he's allowed to do something that I'm not allowed to do based on cultural lines, based on things I can't. I didn't choose to be Somali. I didn't choose, you know, to be African.
Yeah.
But somehow I ought not to question my religion, and so. Anyway, and so I've got a poem in there that's responding to him. And so the collection is, like I had 21 poems. Each poem is responding to a favorite film of mine. Because all these films have, like, brought me comfort throughout my life.
Mm-hmm.
And you find a lot of them are kind of sort of coming-of-age films, because I've always felt like I was coming of age with all the transitions of, you know, being Muslim and, you know, all the changes I made within that. And I'm always felt like I'm coming of age, and so the things in those films relate to the things in my life, so I tie it back to my life, and yeah, let's stop all the clocks.
Wow, that is quite the story, being told by an atheist that you're Islamophobic and he doesn't want you to publish your poems. It's a bigotry of low expectations. It's almost like they get away, you know, this weird, oh man, this unholy alliance that's happening, that's like, it's like kills, it's just awful. But anyways, yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's awesome. It's been a pleasure. Is there any last words you have that you want to say before we end?
No, other than, you know, we live in a time where, you know, our compassion is being kind of manipulated, so, you know, I always say, you know, don't let your reason, you know, don't let your, you know, your reason and rationality be erased, you know, in the face of whatever. So yeah, and one life. So I have this philosophy that I'm developing in real life called the one life philosophy, and basically it's just to live your life because this is all there is. And, you know, we ought to live it, and we ought to use our own mortality, not for like morbid reasons, but we use it to orient us to what really matters in life. So, that's kind of my message as well. So, yeah.
Oh, awesome. I love that. Have you written this out anywhere, this philosophy?
No, I'm developing it now. So like, oh, I've been developing it for a while now. So I'm also going to be exploring that on my YouTube channel as well.
Okay.
So, people just stay tuned for that. Okay. But yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so everyone needs to also follow Muggin on his YouTube channel, Inner Self Rising. podcast is the name. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I really enjoyed it. If you're ever in Canada, if I'm ever in Australia, we need to meet up. I'd love to meet you.
Yes.
It'll be great. And those of you who made it to the end, don't forget to like and subscribe and consider joining the channel. It's most appreciated. Thank you to my patrons for all your continued support. Thank you to Megan, for doing an interview with me. It's been, like I said, 7 months since I'm doing this. I'm really happy that you're the one that I was able to open up the live streaming with as well. So really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I just want to say thank you so much, Abdullah. Like I didn't mention this earlier, but you know, your work has really helped me, you know, unpacking Islam. So it was really very very impactful for me. So I really, really, from the bottom of my heart, appreciate the work that you do. You know, it did help me, particularly when I was coming out of Islam anyway. So.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that I appreciate that. That's always good to hear, because you never know when you do this, like, who is going to reach, right? But halfway across the world, on the other side of the planet, had an impact. So I'm happy to hear that. Yeah, thank you.
All right.
And I will end the stream there. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we'll see you again soon.